But I think leaders who say we want you to act like an owner and who don't actually do things that help inspire people to do that, like give autonomy, give decision-making authority, give trust, make it safe to fail, all of those things. I don't think that any two coaches should try to be like each other. What you need to be is like yourself. Let's face it, leaders are simply human, and we get our feelings hurt, and we get defensive, and we have to lead through that.
Hi, everyone. I'm Dave Tabor, host of the ProCo 360 podcast for people who love Colorado and love learning and hearing from Colorado's most inventive and successful entrepreneurs. Hey, this episode is special. It's to help my friend Carrie Siggins launch her new book, The Ownership Mindset, a handbook for transforming your life and leadership. Carrie is CEO of Durango-based Stone Age. It's an employee-owned specialty manufacturer of water blasting industrial cleaning tools. That's not really what we're going to be talking about, though, tonight. Carrie's path to becoming a CEO is really unusual, and that path is also what has led to Carrie's unique style of leadership and to her expanded career, which includes being a public speaker and now an author. We have a lot to talk about, Carrie.
I'm so excited to be here. Thank you, Dave.
Yes, and this is a super fun episode because we're recording it with a live audience. There they go. All right, we're at Colorado State University's new and beautiful CSU Spur Building. So we're glad you're here, audience. Thank you. Also, shout out to Amy Parsons, CSU president, who helped all this come together. Audience questions are going to be part at the end. All right. First question. You wrote a book. Why?
I've asked that a lot, and I feel like I give a lame answer every time.
Tonight's your chance.
I know, but I'm a writer. So if you're a writer, don't you have to write a book? That's what it feels like.
Yeah.
So I've been writing my whole life, and I was editor-in-chief of my high school newspaper, and I was really inspired by a high school teacher, lit teacher that I had, who really encouraged my writing. And I went to engineering school, so I did something completely different besides writing, and never imagined that I would actually make it happen. But I decided in 2015 I wanted to re-spark that creativity and that passion that I had for writing when I was much younger. And so I started blogging. I created my own website in 2015 and started practicing and finding my voice. And then when the pandemic hit, I thought, this is a perfect time to write a book. I might as well try to do something productive besides sit on my porch and drink wine with my lovely husband, which we did a lot of that too.
Yeah.
But that's when it just said, it's going to come to fruition. I'm going to write this book now.
Cool. Now, the title is The Ownership Mindset, but the subtitle is A Handbook for Transforming Your Life and Leadership. So why'd you expand the title to include life?
Because we're all humans, and we all have to lead ourselves first and lead ourselves well, ideally, before we lead others. And I have a long journey to figuring out what good self-leadership looks like, because I did not lead myself well in my earlier years. And there's no way that I could have learned how to lead a company and build a company if I wouldn't have learned that self-leadership first. And let's face it, we're all leading ourselves every day, whether we do it well or whether we do it poorly. And so that's why the life piece is part of it. It's not just a leadership book. It really is about how you lead yourself too.
Yeah. I mean, you did have kind of a rough young adult period of time, right? And so share some of that and how that brought you to where you are teaching and living leadership?
I mean, I think most of us, not everybody, but most of us have childhood trauma. We go through adversity, and my childhood trauma certainly made an impact on me. I didn't understand it at the time. My father left when I was very young and was in and out of my life and was a pretty mean dad. And so it caused some self-confidence issues and made me feel like I wasn't lovable as I was. So that made me want to change who I was. And so I was constantly like shape-shifting. You know, if you're going to like me if I'm like this, are you going to like me if I'm like that? And that really caused a lot of psychological damage, even though I didn't understand it at the time. And And that journey led me to some pretty dark places that I had to overcome. And I developed substance abuse issues and body image issues. And it led to me ending up on the floor of my apartment in Austin, Texas in 2006, almost dying from an overdose.
Yeah. So then through that, you evolved into where you've become now. One of the interesting stories you tell in your book is sort of this transformation that you experienced in Telluride just by like watching celebrities and sort of trying to take in what's going on around you. Yeah, talk about that.
So my grandfather was an entrepreneur as well. In fact, he was one of the first ESOPs in Colorado, which is really cool. Stone Age is an ESOP company, an employee-owned company. But he moved from the Midwest to Colorado to follow his dream of entrepreneurship, bought a army surplus store in Montrose, Colorado, and turned it into a sporting goods store. And Montrose is a feeder town for Telluride. And I started working in his store when I was young. I convinced him at 12 years old to let me start working in the store. And all of these celebrities would come in and they would shop. And they never had enough warm clothes. And I loved waiting on them. And I loved trying to imagine what styles they were going to pick. And I would help my Aunt Mary, you know, pick different shoes and different clothes and things like that. And so it was really interesting I wasn't poor, but I didn't have a lot. My mom was a single mom. Obviously, my dad wasn't around much. And so I saw this whole different lifestyle that people were living. And I really, really wanted something like that. I did not want to be poor working multiple jobs like my amazing mother did to make ends meet. So it definitely gave me a taste of what the possibilities could be, being able to wait on them in my grandfather's store.
Yeah. So let's talk about some of the sort of chapters in the book. And I'm going to kind of dip into a few of them and ask about them. Chapter two is called A Different Kind of Company. And that struck me as I read it. You know, basically it's how to be a good Stone Age employee, almost like a manual.
Yeah.
And to me, it's like any CEO that agrees with sort of your approach to management could use that chapter more effectively than a handbook.
Yeah.
That's my take.
Yeah. Ideally. I mean, I think that this book is part memoir, part leadership book, and part how to build a great company. And the ownership mindset, the own-it mindset at Stone Age is who we are. And it's a guide for employees who, let's face it, most people don't know how to come into an organization and think and act like an owner. A lot of us are conditioned to not do those things, right? Don't tell me what you think. I don't want to hear about process improvement. I don't want to hear about the problems within the company. And so when you are telling people, no, I really want to hear from you. I want you to help. I want you to be part of this. A lot of people don't believe you. And so we needed to create the own it mindset to give people guidance on how to be successful in this very different culture that we had. So that's why we wrote the own it mindset.
Was it an ESOP when you first came into the company?
It was employee owned, but we were not an ESOP.
But it was employee owned.
Yes.
Right. So when you think about the things that you do as CEO that work best, which ones work best because it is employee owned? And which ones do you think work even if a company's not employee owned?
Yeah. So I think first and foremost, I think ownership really truly is a mindset. That's the name of this book. If you think about it, we own things that we don't care very much about. And we can care very deeply about things that we don't own. And so I try to tell people that you get to choose how you want to show up every day. You get to choose to engage. You get to choose to work hard, to be a great teammate, all of those things that make work so much more fun and enriching if you put that work in. And so we really try to create this culture that would exist even if we weren't employee owned. But
yeah.
I will say that when employees feel like they get to share in the success of the value that they're creating, they can't help but care a little bit more, right? They can't help but say, wow, this is meaningful for me. If I work an extra hour today to serve my customer, if I improve a process that helps us be more efficient, I get to share in that benefit. So it's really hard, I think, to create the type of culture that we have at Stone Age without employee ownership.
Yeah.
But I think that there are things that leaders can do to certainly increase engagement with their team, but it is different.
if you don't actually own a company, you can talk about it, you know, and you see this even in big companies. You know, they talk about, you know, act as if you own it, behave, you know, but they don't.
No.
And so, you know, there seems like there's an impossible gap between a company that truly is employee owned and one that isn't.
Well, I think that there's things that you can do with compensation and profit sharing. We didn't start with ownership. We started with profit sharing. And that was very motivating for people. And a lot of times, I think leaders could change their compensation to structures to be able to say part of your bonus is profit sharing. And that was really impactful at Stone Age. In fact, what inspired the employee ownership program. But I think leaders who say, we want you to act like an owner and who don't actually do things that help inspire people to do that, like give autonomy, give decision-making authority, give trust, make it safe to fail, all of those things you can do to create that deeper engagement where people feel, I might not own this company, but I own my job and I own my effort and I care about something more than myself. But there are a lot of employee-owned companies who don't do the things that we do and who don't have meaningful employee ownership programs and that feeling of ownership because they don't take advantage of tying those things together.
Yeah, that's well put. Shifting gears about sort of the style of leadership that you have, that others have. I know we're here at CSU Spur, and I already apologize to the president, Amy, for what I'm about to do, which is to cite this article from the Wall Street Journal, which says, what Deion Sanders can teach CEOs. Now, I want to do that, and Amy and I agree that I would contrast him to the CSU coach, Jay Norvell, because the styles are so different. But what I wanted to mention in this article is that the writer talks about how CEOs need to be certain during uncertain times. I mean, he's talking about Coach Prime, but being certain during uncertain times and being able to display swagger and confidence and certainty to employees. And I know, though, that you believe, and in your book, you talk about humility and being open to learning, which seems more like the, you know, Coach Norvell's style, perhaps. So how do you think about both and which one's really needed?
Well, I think first and foremost, it has to be authentic. Deion Sanders is Deion Sanders. And so his coaching style aligns with his authenticity. And that's what people want. They want to work for people who are authentic. So there's not any one style that is better than the other. It's do the people who you lead, do they really connect with you? Do they believe that you're honest? Do they believe that you're authentic? Do you inspire them the way they need to be inspired? And every team is different. So I don't think that any two coaches should try to be like each other. What you need to be is like yourself.
Yeah.
And you need to find a way to connect with your players, with your employees in that true, authentic way.
So that means if you believe in humility, listening, questioning, and so forth, that you're going to attract employees to that style versus a different style, right? So your employees are going to be sort of in your mold?
Yes. Not everybody likes to work for me. And I think that the vulnerability that is almost required to be a great employee at Stone Age, because we do so much personal development. You know, I want people to feel like they leave our company as better human beings, and not everybody wants to do that work, right? That's something that's separate. I come to work for my paycheck. And so not everybody is bought into this style. In fact, there's some people out there who are like, you know, it's BS and we don't like it. And that's okay. You know, what we need to do as Stone Age or, you know, any company out there is to find the people who really fit with your culture. And that's probably 2% of the people who are out there. So how do you recruit those very few people who really believe in what you're trying to do and then keep them?
Yeah. So does that mean as a CEO that you know you're going to, I mean, there's always talk about diversity. You're not really talking about a diverse attitudinal approach though, are you?
I think there's room to absolutely be yourself. And we celebrate authenticity, but we do have some very specific values that are important to us, like practice self-leadership. But practicing self-leadership does not mean you're perfect. It means admitting when you're not perfect, admitting when you make mistakes, having the humility to say, I don't know how to do something, having the responsibility to own your attitude and your effort. We have a value of be a great teammate. and be a good relationship builder. And people who aren't good relationship builders really struggle at our company. And it doesn't mean that they can't function. I mean, our founder, one of our co-founders, has Asperger's. He really struggles connecting with people. And we make room for him. And because we do accept and honor quirkiness, but we also hold very true to our values. And that is, we treat each other well. We show up as our true selves. If we're having a bad day, we admit we're having a bad day. We don't blame others. We take responsibility. So yeah, there's room for lots of diversity in there. But if you have a person who isn't accountable, you're not going to probably make it at the company.
Well, you talk about self-development, and there's a great story in the book, and I want you to relate it around a sales manager who told you that you had done some real damage in the organization. Talk about that. Tell the story. Talk about it.
Yeah. So this is not one of my best moments.
Which is why I'm asking you about it right now. Yeah.
So I was probably a year, maybe 2 years into my CEO role, and I had a call from a customer who said, "How could you send me used product?" And he was very angry and he was cussing at me, and I knew him fairly well. And I said, "There's no way we sent you used product." He's like, "I'm gonna send you pictures. I'm gonna show you that you did. So sure enough, I get pictures, and it's a piece of automated equipment that's very expensive, and there's rust all over it, and it definitely looked used. And I did what you should not do as a leader, and that is I projected the way that he was treating me to my team. So I walked down into the shop where we built and packaged and shipped this product, and I said, "How could we send this customer in the Netherlands overseas this product? This is going to cost us a ton of money." And they looked at me wide-eyed. I was very upset. And they said, "Well, I don't think that we did. In fact, I know we didn't. It was new." And I said, "Well, it looks used. It is used. And you need to figure out how to fix it and make sure it never happens again." And I turned and walked out. And as soon as I walked out, I was like, "Oh, I didn't handle that right. And I should have turned around and gone back in and said, I'm sorry," but I didn't. I went up to my office and I called the customer back and I said, we're going to figure out what happened and we're going to take care of it. You know, a new package will be out in 2 days. And our sales manager, who I love dearly, he still works for our company. His name is Jeff. He came into my office and he said, KP, that's what everybody calls me, KP, you did some real damage down there. You know, there's no way that those guys shipped a used product to the Netherlands. And you treated them like you care more about the customer than they do. And that's not true. They care. And you did some significant damage. I don't know how you're going to fix this." And I knew it. I knew when I walked out of the shop that I handled it poorly. And I started crying. I was like, "You're right." And I realized that all I did was just take the anger that the customer was venting at me and projected it on them instead of doing what good leaders do, and that is taking that and protecting the team and seeking to understand and, you know, making sure that you really understand what happened before you make any judgments or accusations. And so there's one employee who it took a couple of years for us to be able to build that relationship because I really broke his trust because I didn't manage my emotions well.
There's a chapter called Believing in Yourself that really caught my attention because it's just not like a pep talk. You can't just say, "Believe in yourself and do it." Like, just do it, the Nike slogan, right? So, you know, let me just ask you about that first. I've got a follow on.
Yeah. So I do think that you need to believe in yourself. And you're right, it isn't easy. And I absolutely spent many of my years not believing in myself, right? Not believing in my gifts and my worth as who I was. I had to pretend I was somebody else. I had to shapeshift for other people. And, you know, when you hit rock bottom and you make that decision of, "That's it, I'm changing my life," at that moment, I knew that I had to do the work. I had to do the work, that nobody was going to come in and save me, and that blaming other people was obviously not getting me anywhere. And so I had to start this journey of believing in myself. And people ask me, like, "How do you do that?" Especially if you have self-confidence issues or are fearful or scared to make a change. And I tell people it's one small step, right? What do you want to leave behind? What do you want to go after? What dream do you want to live? And take one step, because you have to believe in yourself to be able to make those changes. And that's part of the ownership mindset. It doesn't mean that you have to be filled with self-confidence. I mean, I have tremendous imposter syndrome this week going into this book launch, going like, what if it's a terrible book and nobody likes it? And, you know, I'm not going to read any of the bad reviews because like, it's going to make me cry. But when you think about the bigger impact, like, why am I doing this? I'm doing this to change my life. I'm doing this to try to help reduce the stigma around addiction. I'm doing it to try to help people understand that there's a different way to treat your employees and to build a company. And that really does help me get past those times when maybe I do have those self-doubts and I don't believe in myself. And I really think that that's important for everybody out there. Like, the world is so crazy right now. Like, who knows what's going to happen tomorrow? Why not believe in yourself and just go for what you want? Go for it. Now is the time to do it. And so that's why I wrote that chapter, because yeah. I'm so passionate about the changes you can make when you believe in yourself.
I know you are. And so I got to ask another question about that, because like, you were a CEO just starting out. I've been a CEO just starting out. Lots of people in the room just starting out. You can't just believe in yourself like starting out when you know you don't know what you're doing. Like, there's a difference between imposter syndrome, when you kind of know what you're doing, but you still feel uncertain, and when you truly don't know what you're doing.
That's okay. That doesn't mean you don't believe in yourself, right? I had no idea what I was doing when I started out at Stone Age, right? I was hired at 28 years old to take over a company. There was no doubt that I did not know what I was doing. And I knew I didn't know what I was doing. But that didn't mean that I was going to shy away from the challenge. I believe that the only way to get good at doing hard things is to do hard things. And so I could be okay with saying, I don't know how to do this, and still believing that I could figure it out. I could be okay with making a mistake and still believing it that I could fix it. And so I don't think that believing in yourself means that you are filled with unrealistic confidence about your competencies or capabilities. It's just knowing that you can figure it out. I trust myself enough to be able to figure it out, even if I fumble through it. And I think that's what belief is. It doesn't mean that you have all the answers or that you're perfect.
Cool. Take a quick break. Listeners, this is the ProCo 360 podcast. It's a special episode of ProCo 360, named Best Colorado Business Podcast the last 3 years. I'm your host, Dave Tabor. Today, I'm with a live audience. That's your cue. We're here with Carrie Siggins, author of The Ownership Mindset, a handbook for transforming your life and leadership. Is it available now on Amazon?
Yes.
I think it is.
Yeah. Amazon, excellent. The Tattered Cover, the Barnes & Noble, anywhere you buy books.
Excellent. And also, Carrie can be found at carriesiggins.com or via Stone Age, the company. So, all right, I want to refer to another article that caught my attention, which is because it relates to your book. And this headline said, "Bosses say they want the truth. Do they mean it?" So I wanted to ask you what you think about that first. Do most bosses really mean it when they tell people, tell me the truth, give me feedback?
No. And I've been doing this for years, and I still sometimes makes me uncomfortable. And that's okay. Right? Getting feedback, it does. It stings. Like, we're human. It doesn't mean that we're just going to like build this wall because, you know, we are trying to create this different type of culture. Absolutely. I hear things that I don't really want to hear, but that doesn't mean that I don't need to hear them. And it doesn't mean that I don't need to hear them well and to take action. But let's face it, leaders are simply human, and we get our feelings hurt and we get defensive, and we have to lead through that. We have to role model what it takes to say, that just really made me uncomfortable. But you know what? There's some merit to that. And I'm going to really consider it. I'm going to dig into this. I'm going to give you, you know, the opportunity to make this happen, even though I don't necessarily agree with it. So yeah, there's all kinds of discomfort in it.
So, and I get that that's kind of where your headspace is. So what do you do internally at Stone Age Because we're hearing a lot of this where, especially in like tech companies and stuff, where the first employees get promoted and they become the managers and they become the vice presidents, right? And they've got no real training. So how do you help people who know that they've just found their way into these roles? Like, how do you get them to start thinking that they want feedback? They really need feedback, even if they don't want to hear it, right? That's a different kind of thing, isn't
it? Yeah, definitely. Well, we have a culture of feedback. We talk about it constantly. We train people on how to give and receive feedback. I love Kim Scott's book, Radical Candor. And if you haven't read it, please do. It is such a great model for being able to give kind, direct, helpful feedback.
Do you need a whole book for that?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, let's face it. Giving feedback and taking feedback, it's like one of the hardest things that we do as human beings, right? And so I really like that model, her model. It gives a really good visual framework where people can understand where they are in the giving feedback and in the taking feedback realm. But we do. We talk about it. We teach it. We help people through it. Some people are really easy to give feedback to. Some people are really difficult to give feedback to. We teach people how to give people space, right? I have an employee who, no matter what, when you give her feedback, she cries and she hates it. And she's like, do not stop giving me feedback just because I cry. I cannot help it. I can't stop myself. And I would if I could, because it makes people feel bad, but I just have this emotional response. And so instead of her feeling like she has to change herself, we talk to people and say, look, let people have their emotional reaction, right? We're all human and we're all going to react in a certain way, but it doesn't mean that that initial reaction is how we're going to choose to respond. So how do we give people space in that moment? And that only happens with lots of training and lots of talking about it and lots of practice. So we make our employees practice giving feedback.
Wow, that's even more uncomfortable than getting feedback, isn't it?
Yeah, and taking it. And then, but then the other person on the other side has to take it. And how do you do it with grace and compassion and take the good from it? And then also, you know, let some of it go.
Cool. Last piece of the book I want to talk about specifically is near the end where your chapter is called Overcome the Fear of Being Disliked. And I thought, what a powerful notion. Where's that coming from?
Oh, because I want to be liked. I think most of us do. Some of us, it's more of a drive than it is for others. For me, it was a significant drive. My personality type combined with never feeling worthy as a kid of love was a dangerous combination. And I didn't have much help. You know, I grew up in the 90s, in the 80s and 90s. It's not like we had a lot of self-awareness conversations like we do now, at least the ones I have with my 10-year-old son. My mom was not having with me. It wasn't part of, you know, how you raised kids. And so it was really tough because I wanted people to like me. And that's why I was always trying to do things to make sure people did like me. Well, let's face it, when you're a leader, not everybody's going to like you.
And all the time anyway.
Yeah, all the time. And in fact, you shouldn't want that, right? You should want people to respect you and you should do things to earn that respect, but not likability. Now, on the other hand, likability is a very positive trait. When people like you, they're more willing to listen to your ideas and your opinions. They're more willing to give you feedback. And so I do think that being likable is a worthy leadership trait. But when you do things or don't do things because you have a fear of not being liked, that's when it can be a very slippery slope. And early on in my career, I had to balance that because I was young. I was 28. I was coming off of, I was going through a really rough time in my life. And I definitely made decisions to make sure people liked me, or I didn't make decisions because I thought people would like me. And I had to learn that. I had to learn that likability wasn't everything.
All right. We're going to stop talking about the specifics of the book because listeners have to read it,
yes,
right?
Yes.
Get it and read it. So I'm going to switch gears and talk about this journey of writing a book. What did you learn through the process? I tried it once. I failed. It's hard.
It's so hard to write a book. Yeah, I don't know that I could have done it if I wouldn't have written it during the pandemic. It's really tough to sit down and write a book, especially when you're incredibly busy. And the only reason I was able to do it is because I stopped traveling. And then I had to create discipline. And I had a writing cohort. I joined a writing cohort that every 2 weeks we'd meet and we had to come back and say if we met our commitment or not. And I'm big on accountability, and I don't like saying I'm going to do something and not do it. So that was exactly what I needed to be able to get the book done. And so that was very helpful. But yeah, it's very hard, and it is an incredibly vulnerable experience. It's even, for me at least, it's even more vulnerable than speaking. I know a lot of people have a fear of getting up on stage and speaking, and I don't have that. But putting the written words in a book in print that lives forever, it definitely is a very vulnerable process.
Did some things about you reveal themselves that you weren't intending in the book?
Oh, yeah, definitely. Yeah.
Like what?
Well, maybe that I wasn't intending, but I definitely learned about myself during the writing process. I learned that I need to do things in chunks of time. I'm usually a, how do I get as many things done in a given moment? So I'm late for everything because I'm like, ooh, I can just get this one more thing done. And then I will leave. And then I'm always like 5 minutes late for everything. And so that actually really made me think a lot about how I was showing up and being fully present and not trying to multitask so much. And so I try to do more of that, of like really being present and not doing so many different things, because I'm so much more creative when I just give myself time. So it was things like that. I've been writing for such a long time before the book came out that I had lots of practice being able to get my thoughts out on paper and start practicing with the vulnerability of sharing my story.
Cool. Listeners, got another question or two for Carrie, but if you've got a question you'd like to ask, love to have you do it from the audience. Just get up to the mic and don't be shy. All right. So what do you think, what value do you think readers ended up in the book or from in the book that like you hadn't gone into it thinking you were going to deliver?
So it's really funny. Someone just texted me today and said, I am using this book as a way to like help guide my intuition. So whenever I'm like, I'm struggling with a problem, I just flip open a page and I read that. And it's amazing. Like, it's exactly the problem that I am dealing with. And I thought, that's so cool. Like, I didn't even think the book would be used like that. So that was just, you know, a funny little antidote. But different things resonate with different people. I have lots of people. Look, my book is not a story about being a troubled child, right? It definitely is part of my story, and I put that in there. But some people, especially those who struggle with addiction or have had family members struggle with addiction, that's what really resonates with them, is how to, you know, overcome rock bottom and create this different life. Some people, the leading other people really resonates. Some, the how do you make a big impact? So I think there's something for everybody in it to inspire you to really think about how you lead yourself and lead others.
Would you mind coming up to the mic, please? Yeah, just your name and fire away with your question, please.
Hi, TJ Suter, Vanguard Systems. Carrie, what would you suggest if you had a whole group of different people and you wanted to create a new culture? What would be the first step?
The first step is to define the culture that you have. There's always something good to build on, and I think that's really important. We've dramatically changed the Stone Age culture, but we stayed true to our roots. Like, we really said, what made this company so special, even in those times when you lose your way, which every company does? It's really hard to maintain culture, and it's going to change as you grow and scale. So I say find those things that are really the roots of your company, why you built it, what your purpose is, and then start saying, now what do we want to be? What do we want to aspire to be? Where are the problems that we have that aren't creating the culture that we want, and how do we change it? My best advice is to keep it simple. Don't try to do too much. I think a lot of people get overwhelmed, especially when you have to go through a cultural transformation and go, oh my God, where do I even get started? I have so much to change. Pick one thing. This is one thing that we're going to work on, and we're going to make that better. And then we're going to work on the next one. But I think it's really important to stay true to your roots.
Okay. Thank you.
Yep. Thanks.
Another question, please.
Hi, I'm Devin Tilley with the Art of Construction podcast and friends of Ryan and Carrie. What I'm really curious about is, you said it was so hard to write the book, but I'm sitting here listening to this and I'm very inspired by this. Two questions. The first one is, are you glad you wrote the book? And are you going to do another book? And the bonus part of, with ChatGPT and AI and all this stuff, if they're going to write the books for us, How's that going to work?
Yeah. So first question, yes, I'm very glad I wrote the book. I think that it's really important to live your dreams. And I always wanted to write a book. And so even if no one bought it and it was a terrible book, I still wrote a book. And so, yeah, I'm really glad that I followed through on a commitment that I made to myself many, many years ago. So it's a very rewarding process. And then am I going to write a second book? Yes. I already have the outline ready.
Really? What's it called?
I don't have a title yet, but it's going to be about, and it's actually interesting, it ties into Devin's question. It's going to be about our relationship with work and on our path, on our journey to find purpose and meaning in our work. So this book is going to be very different. Like I said, this one's part, The Ownership Mindset is part memoir. The next book is going to be about other people's stories. And I want to interview hundreds of people who either hate work, who have found balance in work, and who are workaholics, and pull the thread on this journey of how we find meaning and passion in our work. And then what that looks like as we go through this technology revolution that we're about to go under, which is going to be, you know, in some ways probably more transformative than the Industrial Revolution, which actually I think made people not like work as much. And so I want to tie those things together. Am I going to have ChatGPT write my book? No. I think that is not in alignment with my brand. I am an authentic person and I love to write and I want to make sure I use my voice. Will I have ChatGPT help me? Absolutely.
Like edit, maybe.
Yeah, edit. And, and you know, there's so many good things that can come from it. But no, every word that will be written in that book will be mine. But I can certainly use ChatGPT to help make the process a little bit faster. But you know, I think the way that AI is going to change things is we're going to really truly seek out and appreciate true artisans, because let's face it, AI is going to make better movies. They're going to make better music. They're probably going to write better than us, but it's not real. And I think we're going to find that we really miss the realness of humanity. And then we're going to seek out people who actually create art in their writing and their music and their words and their performances. So I don't know, maybe it's a pipe dream, but that's where I'm hoping we go.
It's encouraging though. Last question for you, unless we've got any more from, come on, Meg.
Hello, Meg Vanderlaan from Encore Electric. You talked about different kinds of leaders, and I'm curious, who are those leaders who inspired you in your journey?
Sure. My grandfather is first and foremost, and unfortunately, he passed away before, like right when I was becoming a CEO, and I didn't get to pick his brain like I wish that I would have been able to. But he was so forward-thinking and very disruptive in what he was trying to create with his company and with employee ownership back in the 70s and 80s. And he was always just an inspirational leader. His employees loved working for him. So I always aspired to really be like him. I also really appreciate very vocal and strong and authentic leaders. I'm a huge fan of Michelle Obama. I think that her authenticity and her journey is truly remarkable. And the way that she shares her stories is really inspiring. And I can really appreciate the sacrifices that she had to make to go on this journey. And so, you know, leaders like that have these really, truly incredible stories that they share with openness and authenticity, I admire that. And it's not about any particular leadership style or politics or anything like that. It's like, how do we connect in with the humanity of who we are, and how do we tell those stories that allow people to feel that passion that you feel and be inspired by it?
All right, last question for you, which is, what Emily talked about in the book that's on your mind relative to the ownership mindset that you want to talk about before we wrap up?
I don't think so. I think you did a really good job covering so much of it. It's been a real pleasure to chat with you today and to explore the book and this wild journey that I've been on and hopefully just getting started with.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. Well, let's wrap up. Listeners, this is a special episode of ProCo 360. I'm your host, Dave Tabor, and we've been listening to Carrie Siggins' book launch episode. Carrie is the CEO of Stone Age and the author of The Ownership Mindset, a handbook for transforming your life and leadership. This episode is going to be on in about a week at proco360.com. Also, go to carriesiggins.com. We all know Carrie, and you won't have any trouble finding it on social media either.
No, will we, Carrie? No, I'm really good at that.
Yes, everyone in the audience, Carrie and I are so glad that you joined us.
Yeah, thank you.
Thanks so much, and happy you were here.
Thank you.